James Harden going to sign their extension.
His trade value is not there. And when you hear reports...
Phil has been paid $16 million of his $33 million salary.
I know about people that have certain clauses
what
in their contract.
What happens next year with Giannis Antetokounmpo? He will be eligible for a Supermax next summer. If he re-signs a new reality, the players are going to move around. And the players are not going to want to spend their whole, you know, life...
And because they didn't want to go into the penalty of the luxury tax, they traded James Harden. Somebody's going to be making $50 million a year.
He probably could have made a little bit more money this summer in free agency.
I think he could have got a lot more in the offseason. When you got a chance to secure the bag,
you gotta secure it, man.
No question.
What's going on, party people? I'm your host, Steven Bagel, and this is another episode of Sports Ethos's very own The Bird Rights Podcast. So I know I've been a little MIA recently. Life is busy, especially with we have a new CBA finally. You know, there's been rumors all season. They keep pushing back the dates. But alas, we finally have an agreement between the Players Association and the league and the owners. So who else to bring on to discuss it other than CBS's own Sam Quinn? Sam, how are you doing today?
Even I'm doing well, a little tired. You know, the negotiations really dragged on. I mean, we were supposed to be done in, what, I think December was the original deadline.
Yeah.
So it took a little bit longer than expected, but we're almost there. We don't have a term sheet yet. We haven't had a vote yet, but it seems like we're close. It seems like we know what's going to happen here.
So, yeah, I mean, let's just start diving into things. I think the biggest takeaway from the new CBA is the aspect of, and again, we're going to talk about this with one of our topics that we have here, but let's just get into it now. It's the super tax, as Sam coined it in an article, and other people are starting to, you know, I know Keith Smith from Spotrac started referring to super tax. I know Sam.
Yeah, this was Keith's brainchild. I stole it from Keith. Brilliant term. I've been using super tax as well.
Okay. So let's quickly explain what the super tax is. There's always been the luxury tax apron, where, you know, if a team gets themselves hard cap, they cannot go over that luxury tax apron. Now there is a second apron, which is, I believe, $17.5 million above the luxury tax threshold.
Yes. So the basic, I mean, just to make sure all of our bases are covered here, the NBA uses a couple of different salary lines for, you know, for different distinctions. There's the salary cap figure. If you're under that figure, great, you can spend up to that with free agency. There's the luxury tax line. You stay below that line, you don't pay the tax. Great. Then there's the apron, which is usually around $6 million above that line. Usually for most teams, it's not going to come into play. If you acquire a player with a sign and trade, if you use the non-tax MLE, there are a few different ways that you can bring that apron figure into play. And if you do, you can't go over it for any reason. Now we have the second apron, or the super tax that Keith coined it. The basic premise here is if you are above this line, a whole new set of restrictions come into play. So far as we know right now, the big ones are if you're over this line, you can't use the tax pyramid level. If you're over this line, you cannot make unbalanced trades from a salary perspective. You have to send out as much money as you bring in or send out more, obviously. But you can't make the trades where, like, you send out $30 million and you bring in $40 million. Those are the big ones. There are a couple of other smaller ones that come into play. But the essential point here is that if you are above that super tax line, yeah, you're going to be able to keep your players in most, you know, in most situations. It's going to be much harder for you to bring in players from the outside.
Sounds to me like the name of this podcast, the Bird Rights Pod, it sounds like bird rights are going to be a hell of a lot more important now. And draft picks as well. I mean, I know that if you're, I believe it was if you're above the super tax or post at the super tax line, you are unable to trade draft picks more than 7 years out anyway.
Yeah, so the way it works is you have, in most cases, you can trade picks up to 7 years away. If you're a super tax team, you can only trade picks 6 years away. So just as an example, Phoenix just trades for Kevin Durant, and they trade 2023, 2025, 2027, and 2029, I believe.
Yes,
that last year, 2029, would not have been available to Phoenix in this scenario if they were above that line. You know, the James Harden trade with Brooklyn was another one where if you're above that line, they couldn't have traded that last. Although I think that one was actually a swap. Not 100% sure, but you get the idea. If you're over this line, you can only go 6 years out.
So you can't even go 7 years out for a swap? Or are you not sure?
I'm not sure yet. We're going to see. Okay. We haven't seen the term sheet yet. I'm going to assume that any draft pick 7 years out is untouchable.
That's what
I'm
going to
assume. You
well.
Can't even do swaps. But for now, we haven't seen a term sheet. And just something I want to put out there for all the listeners is, I know that there's been a lot of reporting on some of the changes in this. It's not all out there yet, strictly because we haven't seen a term sheet yet and they haven't voted yet. There's still room for tweaks. There's still room for more reporting. Like, I was listening to Zach Lowe and Bobby Marks the other day. They did a podcast, and I believe it was Bobby that put out there that you're going to be able to use the non-tax mid-level exception as a trade exception if you don't spend it in free agency, which was not something that had been reported previously over the weekend. And frankly, it was not something that I had heard before, but Bobby is as plugged in with this stuff as anybody. So if he put that out there, I would say that's as close to a sure thing as there is. There are going to be more little tweaks like that that we're going to get in the coming days and the coming weeks. So anything we say now is based on the reporting as of today, Friday, April 7th. There is a lot of room for, let's say, minor things to change. We understand the basic structures right now, but there are going to be smaller changes to come.
And ironically enough, I mean, as we talked about when we first started talking about the super tax, is the aspect of big spenders, and everyone's using the examples of the Warriors and the Clippers, are kind of not hamstrung, because a lot of the Warriors, I know they did get Kevin Durant at one point, but I mean, they're all homegrown. Steph, Clay, Draymond, Jordan, Paul. They drafted all those guys, and they're all homegrown players. So I don't want to say that, you know, there's not another dynasty in the NBA's future, because there very well could be. But again, this makes bird rights way more important. You're going to want to keep your guys because you're not going to be able to replace them because of the aspect that of it's making being able to acquire players a hell of a lot more difficult. And as a result, that makes your draft picks more important, because that's, you know, your main way to acquire and develop talent. So I'm just interested to see how, you know, down the line, it'll affect the NBA. We are going to talk about it probably towards the end of this pod of when we could expect these changes to be implemented, because right now, I don't think that's an answer that anybody, you know, really knows the answer to.
It's not going to be this summer, at least as far as we know, at least most of them. I would assume, and again, we're in very much in murky waters here. I would assume we start to see a couple of the smaller ones. Like, I would think we'll get the bigger non-tax MLE this offseason. I would think we get the bigger cap room exception this offseason. But I think the restrictive things are going to come into play maybe a year, 2 years down the line.
Yeah, and they said it might be a gradual thing, so we might not even see it fully, you know, take effect right away in this next 1 or 2 years, as you're saying. But, okay, so we talked about the MLE, so let's move on to that. So it seems like, or it's been reported that the mid-level exception has increased by 7.5%, and the cap room exception for teams that have cap space goes up by a whopping 30%. So have we heard anything in regard to, I'm assuming the taxpayer MLE is remaining the same, because that would be a little counterintuitive.
And notably, something to keep in mind here is that the tax MLE, I believe, had been bigger than the cap room MLE, and now that's going to switch. Now the cap room MLE is going to be the second biggest and tax is going to be the third, which I think we all probably would have assumed was the correct from a competitive balance standpoint. I think that was a good move. But if you kind of zoom out a little bit, something that this does is we have very rarely, I mean, over the last few years, we really have not seen many like big cap space teams do the thing where they clear out like 50 million in room and sign either like a star, two stars, or a bunch of different players. I think that's going to be encouraged now, because you're going to have an avenue to filling that depth. Whereas in the past, you'd feel like, oh, we're spending 30 million on one free agent. We have no way to fill in our depth after that. Well, I don't know. I'll just throw out a name. Like, say you're Orlando and you sign Fred VanVleet this offseason for, you know, 30 million, something like that. Well, now you're going to have this cap room mid-level for a much bigger chunk than it had previously been that you could use to, maybe we sign another big, maybe we sign another wing. It's really going to encourage more player movement on that slightly sub-star level among the non-big market teams, which I think the NBA had really wanted, because what we've seen over the past few years is free agency has A, been decided in like 15 minutes. We knew where everybody was going right away. And B, big players weren't really changing teams in free agency that often anymore. We got what I think Jalen Brunson did last year. He was one of the bigger ones. I think we didn't have many big names last year, as I recall. So I think the NBA wants to balance out a little bit more between trades and free agency. I think this is one way that they're trying to do that.
And not ironic, but the aspect of, I feel like the last CBA that was implemented when they made the Supermax a thing where, you know, you could only sign it with your own the team that you got all NBA for, like Kawhi Leonard, Anthony Davis, those guys requested trades anyway, but that made them non-Supermax eligible. So I feel like that CBA was more focused on keeping guys in smaller markets happy by, okay, only this specific small market team that you've been with could pay you that amount. But now this CBA, yes, it does punish bigger spenders like the Warriors and Clippers. But as you said, now you're getting rewarded for having cap space and it's encouraging more player movement again. So I feel like it does balance it out a little bit when, you know, you still have the Supermax in play and everything like that. So that's just an interesting caveat that I noticed.
Well, let me throw something out there to you. Okay. Since you bring up the Supermax, it's something I've been thinking about. Do you think, as far as its intended benefit, like the intended goal of the Supermax was to keep the players like Kevin Durant in Oklahoma City, do you think it's been successful? I would argue it's probably done more harm than good. I mean, I think Jimmy Butler was a clear case where the Bulls traded him because they did not want to give him the Supermax. We're going to look back and forget this at the time, but at the time it was a big story. Sacramento did not want to give DeMarcus Cousins the Supermax. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, you look at some of the guys who've actually gotten it. Russell Westbrook, bad contract. John Wall, bad contract. Bradley Beal is, I think, veering towards bad contract. Although Bradley Beal is a 10-year veteran, I think, when he signed it. So he might have had access to it either way. But meanwhile, you look at the guys like, did it keep Kawhi Leonard in Toronto? No, it wasn't designed to. Did it keep Anthony Davis in New Orleans? No, it didn't. Like, the best players, the high-end players, it kind of hasn't really done what it's been intended to do.
Same thing with Kemba Walker. I mean, the Hornets didn't want to pay him, and he ended up walking for nothing. And you know what? For them, that's probably a good thing, given how Kemba's knees have responded in recent years. Obviously, he's not even in the league right now. So, but yeah, just going back, that's another example of, you know, Hornets didn't want to pay him because he was Supermax eligible at the time, and they didn't feel comfortable giving that to him. I don't think they felt comfortable giving him a normal max.
As far as I can recall at the time, and I don't have details in front of me, but my feeling at the time was they were just ready to move on. Like, they would have taken him back, but there was all that reporting at the time that they wanted to have him on the team because they were hosting All-Star Weekend, and they wanted to, like, have him as the ambassador, and that's maybe why they didn't trade him, which was really ridiculous. But, I mean, just as a general point of emphasis here, like, the Hornets are not an example any team should look at, and we shouldn't be using them as, like, you know, they're not a team that's managed the CBA quite well.
They did end up getting Terry Rozier in that sign and trade for Kemba, for what that's worth. So,
okay, but that's done more harm than good, because now they have Terry Rozier on a $25 million a year contract.
Oh, yeah, they extended him. I'm not saying the Hornets overall are in good franchise, or I don't want to say that, but, you know, as you said, they don't make the greatest decisions and don't navigate the CBA the best. But anyway, let's move on. So the most surprising thing to me, at least, is that for years, when draft picks started changing hands, everyone was kind of anticipating this double draft that would maybe be in 2025, somewhere along the lines, because of the fact that, okay, guys aren't thrilled with doing college players. At least they have to go to college for a year now instead of coming straight out of high school for the NBA. So that was one thing that most people did anticipate that had been discussed heavily for years at this point. And quite frankly, from what I've heard at least, NBA scouts, evaluators, GMs, they don't want to have to go to high school gyms and scout these guys. I mean, from all over the place. They would rather go overseas or go to colleges and be plugged in with March Madness or G League Ignite or Overtime Elite, excuse me. So now that it's out that there is no one-and-done provision, I'm not all that surprised. It's just more the aspect that for years we were kind of anticipating it.
So I think it's one of those things where we all looked at it from a fan's perspective and we just sort of thought, well, this is common sense, right? You know, high schoolers should be able to make money in the NBA if, you know, they're 18, they're eligible to work, like they should be able to. We never stopped and looked at it from a labor perspective. And it's interesting that when this was initially changed, I think 2006, 2007, it was the owners that said, we are sick of letting high schoolers into the NBA who are not ready to be professionals. You know, for every LeBron James, there are five of these guys who are ultra talented who get to the NBA and clearly aren't ready to be in the pros and either sit on the bench for several years or just never mature. So at the time, that was an owner-driven decision to add the one and done. Well, now, if you look at this purely from a player's perspective, say you're, I don't know, an 8-year NBA veteran making a minimum salary. Would you rather be competing against a normal draft class for jobs or a double draft class for jobs? Because if they do a double draft and suddenly there's twice as many, you know, NBA caliber youngsters entering the league at one time, if you're one of these fringe minimum salary players, it's going to be a lot harder for you to get a roster spot. So that's what I think ultimately happened here. The NBPA represents past players. It represents present players, but it doesn't represent future players. You are not a member of the NBPA until you get to the NBA. So what happened here is that I think a lot of these, you know, fringier veterans looked at this double draft and said, wait a second, this is going to cost us jobs. We don't want this. They had a seat at the table. The 18-year-olds who want to get to the NBA, they don't have that seat yet. And by the time they get into the NBA, they can look back on it and say, I don't want to make life harder on myself. So ultimately, this was just a matter of who in the NBPA really wanted the double draft. It didn't benefit any of the players. The one exception would maybe be LeBron James because he wants his son in the NBA as quickly as possible. But that's one guy compared to an entire union. So there was just no reason on the player's side to push for this.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely makes sense in that aspect, in that regard. But I don't know, the double draft would have been a one-year thing. But even so, that 1 year could... A guy falls out of the league and then he's never back. So
remember, it's once a player is out of the league, it is really hard to get back in. Mm-hmm. How often do you see, like, there are exceptions for sure, but how often do you see a guy go unsigned for an entire year and then come back the next year like nothing happened? It's pretty rare.
Yeah, I'm thinking those Kemba Walker's been out, Isaiah Thomas been out, Boogie's been
those
out.
Those are also, those are big name former All-Stars.
But Marcus Aldridge fell out.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the guys that, like, I don't know, like, I'm just, who's a random guy who's been in the NBA for 6 or 7 years, who's just hanging on as, like, the 13th guy on a team for the minimum? Those are the guys that would have been affected. Those are the guys that teams would have looked at and said, there is no upside here. All we know is this guy is a fringe guy. I'd rather have a young guy with upside or a former All-Star with a different sort of upside. Those are the guys who would have been affected. So it makes sense to me that those were the guys who were pushing within the union. And by the way, if you're not one of those guys immediately, for all you know, you could become one of those guys in a year. Things can change really quickly in the NBA. One injury, one bad shooting season, it doesn't take much.
Yeah. And okay. So then the other thing that I think is really notable is the rookie contracts and the rookie extensions you could sign now, because it was always you couldn't get a fifth year unless you got the max. The most notable, the most notable example I thought of was DeAndre Ayton this past summer and the fact that Phoenix ended up matching Indiana's offer almost immediately. And everyone's like, oh, well, it didn't seem like Phoenix wanted him. Phoenix didn't want him at the 5-year max contract that he was eligible for. And obviously, that's what he was pushing for. But the second it became a 4-year contract, not at the max that Indiana signed him to an offer sheet for, it was a no-brainer for Phoenix, apparently. Now, I do think DeAndre Ayton, they couldn't have lost him for nothing. I still, in my opinion, do envision a DeAndre Ayton swap for Miles Turner somewhere down the line, because I think it makes sense for both teams. But on the other hand, now we're going to see, like, the one I know people on, like, let's just say Pelicans Twitter, they're like, okay, now we could get Trey Murphy for a fifth year without giving him the max. I mean, this is going to affect a lot of guys. I know it was reported today that the Sixers want to keep Tyrese Maxey now on, of course, a fifth year, because you could compare him in that realm of a Jordan Poole or a Tyler Hero. I think they're all the same caliber player, and both those guys, Poole and Hero, got, I believe it was about 4-4, 120-ish.
It was in that ballpark. Yeah, I think Poole was a little higher, but yeah.
Yeah, but now Maxey could get a 5-4, let's say 160, 170. So he could get a help. He could get that fifth year, assuming, you know, they implement that within this year. So that's an interesting caveat that, you know, you can now keep your young players for an extra year team control. And that goes back to how I said the super tax makes draft picks more important. If you hit on your draft picks, you're getting these guys for an extra, you know, 9 years, because the 4-year rookie contract and the 5-year extension if they'd be willing to sign it. So now you're getting 9 years of team control on your young guys rather than, you know, 8.
I can't believe I'm bringing it back to Kemba Walker again, but Kemba Walker is a really good example of the sort of contract or the sort of player that these contracts are really going to help. Because after Kemba Walker's third season, he wasn't an all-star yet, right? Like, Kemba was, the 10th pick, something like that. Like, late lottery pick, took a couple of years to develop. But the Hornets couldn't sign him for 5 years because he wasn't a max-level player yet. So they only sign him for 4, and they lose him probably a year earlier than maybe they would have otherwise preferred. You kind of go back through NBA history, and for the most part, it works out. But there are a number of guys who quietly did not get 5-year rookie extensions because they weren't max level players. I mean, I'll give you two really big ones. Giannis Antetokounmpo did not get a 5-year max. He only got 4 years. And by the way, there was a minute there that looked really stupid for the Bucks, because we all thought Giannis might leave. He ends up extending, but there was a minute there where we thought, oh wow, the Bucks really should have given him 5 years. The other one, the really notable one, I think, is Stephen Curry, because not only did he only get 4 years, he got 4 years at like a bargain basement price. So there are a lot of guys throughout history, basically any superstar that developed a bit later than, you know, other stars, were probably somebody who were only stuck with that 4-year deal. And this ends up costing the team down the line, because you've got to bump them up to the max a year earlier. Now, if you can get a guy locked up at, let's say, his third year value for an extra year at the back end, you're getting another prime year at below market value. So this is going to be great for teams.
Yeah, let's segue that. You just talked about, you know, Steph Curry playing on a bargain contract on his rookie extension. That leads me into what is now being coined as the Jaylen Brown rule. And I think it, guys, before we get into it, obviously it's named after Jaylen Brown. So guys like Jaylen Brown, guys like DeJounte Murray, it's going to affect them differently. DeMontis Sabonis. But basically, you couldn't extend a veteran past, what was it, 120% of what they were currently on the last year.
120% of the last year of their deal. That's now up to 140%. The exception here, and this had been a major talking point in Boston all year, was you can supersede that rule if you're eligible for the Supermax. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of pressure on Jaylen Brown to make Supermax and be eligible. Now that's off the table for him. Now Jaylen Brown is going to be eligible for his normal max no matter what. And if he gets to the Supermax, I mean, hey, that's a bonus for him. Now, that's not going to affect every player equally, of course, because you look at DeJounte Murray and you think DeJounte Murray is a $35 million, $40 million a year player. Well, DeJounte Murray right now in the last year of his deal is making less than $18 million. Mm-hmm. Even if you bump him up 140%, that's not close to his true value. That's like $25 million a year. Yeah. So there are going to be guys that this really affects, but there are going to be guys like Murray that it doesn't. And Atlanta is coming out of the CBA is one of the big losers here, because they're going to, like, the reality here is that Murray is going to be a free agent in 2024. I don't know if he's going to leave. Maybe they'll max him out. Maybe he won't have a better option. But they're not going to be able to extend DeJounte Murray. That's just a fact of this new CBA. The rule was designed with Jaylen Brown in mind, and it's going to work out, presumably, for Jaylen Brown in Boston. It's just not going to work out for every team, and I think that's an important distinction, Because there are a lot of teams right now that are looking around and saying, why can't we just give our guy whatever he wants? Why can't we just say, we want to give Murray 35, he wants 35? I don't have a good answer for that. I've never heard a good explanation for why teams can't just pay players whatever they want in extensions. I mean, there have been, maybe you could say you don't want to artificially inflate salaries from trade perspective. That's the only good answer I can come up with. Even that, I'm not crazy about. Personally, I'm of the opinion that you should just be able to pay guys whatever both of them think they're worth. But apparently the NBA disagreed and we came on this compromise with Jaylen Brown.
So yeah, you just mentioned DeJounte Murray. I just mentioned DeMontis Sabonis, same thing. I think he makes about 70.
He'll supermax though. Yeah. He'll be eligible for the supermax. Oh, yeah. I don't know if they'll want to give it to him, but he'll be eligible.
Okay, then what about what about a guy like Kyle Kuzma, Jakob Poeltl? Same thing. I mean, obviously those guys aren't going to be supermax, but quite frankly, Kuzma's make and Poeltl making what, $11 and $13 million each? They're not gonna, you know, sign an extension for doing the math. What? That's a few extra mil. I mean, that's an extra, maybe Kuzma, maybe. But I think Kuzma's going to be a $20+ million player, or at least want to be this summer.
I can tell you pretty comfortably what's going to happen with Kyle Kuzma is we're going to get to like June 10th, and there's going to be some rumor about, oh no, Kyle's headed to this big market team. I don't know what it's going to be, but it's going to be a big market team. And then on July 1st, all of a sudden, Kuzma's going to sign with the Wizards. And we're all going to double take and be like, wait, Kyle Kuzma got how much? That's what's going to happen. The Wizards are just too obsessed with their 38-win seasons that they're going to overpay to keep Kyle Kuzma. And he's going to use that to really drive up his price. So that's what's going to happen with Kyle.
Yeah, that's fair. But yeah, I just said the math. He'd be at about $18 million, which he wants more. He wants the big city. He wants to be a number one or two option, and he wants to get paid. He wants all three of those things. And Washington could maybe give him one of them, but
they're gonna Washington's gonna pay him so much that he's gonna stay.
Yeah, no,
that's just the reality.
I think so as well.
If Kyle Kuzma had his pick, I'm sure he'd rather make $25 million being a Laker than a Wizard. But the Lakers aren't gonna have $25 million to offer him, so here we are.
Speaking of the Lakers, let's talk about the Rob Pelinka rule. I'm trying to work on these transitions, if you couldn't tell. But Rob Pelinka rule. Basically, the Lakers have been, surprisingly, because I'm not a big Rob Pelinka guy, but
I am not either.
Yeah, I know. I think they've done a But Pelinka's done, actually, the one thing he's done a great job is picking guys off the scrap heap as either a second-round pick or an undrafted guy, and develop them into a legitimate role player. We've seen this with Alex Caruso. We've seen it now with Austin Reeves. We've seen it with Talen Horton-Tucker. Max Christie, the second-round pick this year, not quite yet, but
Max, in the minutes we've seen him this year, it's gone the way the early Austin Reeves minutes went last year, where the box score stats weren't there. But if you're watching, oh, there's good stuff here. Max is going to be in the rotation next year. I feel pretty confident saying that.
And the issue is, now that, you know, you're saying Max Christie is going to be a rotation guy next year, is that Pelinka does a great job at nabbing these guys off the scrap heap, but he always wants to use, you know, whatever exception the Lakers have, the in full, to get a Lonnie Walker or to get a Kendrick Nunn, and doesn't leave anything left over for any of these undrafted or second-round guys, so they're subject to two-year minimums rather than getting a third year for a little bit more.
You know what's hilarious about this, by the way? He didn't give Kendrick Nunn the full tax mid-level. They gave him $5 million. They had room under the mid-level to give Austin Reeves a little bit more. They just didn't. Like, they really easily could have structured it that way. They just didn't.
Well,
but this rule, I don't want to – it might just be the Rob Pelinka rule to Lakers Twitter – but it is, I feel comfortable calling it the Rob Pelinka rule. Let's just go down the list. Talen Horton-Tucker, two-year minimum. Austin Reeves, two-year minimum. Max Christie, two-year minimum. The Talen Horton-Tucker, two-year minimum, essentially cost them Alex Caruso. Mm-hmm. The Austin Reeves, two-year minimum, is going to cost them lot of money. They're going to keep him, but it's going to cost them a lot of money. They couldn't give Austin Reeves with this new... So the new exception is there's going to be a direct exception for second round picks.
Just
that
like
is not going to be the minimum. Yes, exactly. We don't know the exact salary. We don't know how long it's going to be able to go. I would guess it'll be 3 years at a little bit more than the minimum, but we'll check in later. I'm not 100% sure on that. So those exceptions are going to be able to be used on guys like Talen Horton-Tucker and Max Christie, so that hopefully you can keep them in the building, you know, develop them without having to pay them right away. Now, Austin Reeves was undrafted, so it wouldn't apply to him. But, you know, actually, something I thought of at the top of my head. We've seen a lot of maneuvering in the last few years from agents specifically, getting guys undrafted rather than getting them to be second-round picks. Because, just frankly, if you're a second-round pick, you might get picked by the wrong team. You might get picked by a team that can't use you. A lot of agents would much rather have a guy go undrafted, pick the right team for them, and get them a two-way deal. I wonder now how this exception is going to change that. Is the promise of a third season going to get more agents to play ball with teams? Or is it going to convince more players to say, you know what? No, I really want to push to have my choice because I don't want to be constrained to a team for 3 years. I think there will be cases of both, but we'll see how it plays out in practice.
Yeah, and those examples, I know we're going through our blinker rule, but there's a guy like Ayo Dosunmu who's now already going to hit free agency, and there's the whole arenas rule provision and everything like that, but you know, if he had a third year, he wouldn't already be hitting free agency 2 years in. So I think that will have some...
Well, I mean, I haven't thought about this, but this is essentially the end of the Gilbert Arenas provision outside of undrafted guys. Now that I think about it, if this exception lasts 3 years, then the only way that the Gilbert Arenas provision would play in would be an undrafted player you signed for a two-year minimum that would only have early bird rights. So essentially, the Gilbert Arenas provision will exist for Austin Reeves types and nobody else. But the Austin Reeves types are pretty rare. Like, how many second-year undrafted free agents are good enough to potentially warrant a backloaded contract like that?
Alex Caruso and Austin Reeves.
Even Alex Caruso only got the non-tax mid-level.
And it's looking like a bargain contract.
I'm actually not sure what Caruso would be worth if he was a free agent. Now, the injuries are a concern. Like, and the minutes, too, for that matter. Like, I don't know. It's a good question, but Reeves is a pretty rare case. The thing about getting more than the non-tax mid-level most of the time is it can't just be you're a good role player. You have to be able to score, like, at least 15 a game before teams are really thinking about throwing that around. And the number of guys just in general that can do that are pretty rare. You can do that as a second year undrafted. Like, man, this is what makes Austin Reeves so special. He's in his second season and he's already doing this. Like, oh boy, he's got a lot of room to grow.
Then the last two topics I want to talk about. The first one is cap smoothing. So we saw the 2016 offseason when there was this huge new TV deal. And the salary cap increased by, I think it was 30-40%. It was a
32%, yeah.
Okay, there you go. And as a result, the Golden State Warriors, who went 73-9 the year before, got Kevin Durant.
They'll swear to you, by the way, that they were going to do that either way. What they'll say is they would have gotten rid of Iguodala and it would have created the same cap space. I call shenanigans on that. I don't think that was going to happen, but that's sort of been a rebuttal that's floated around. But yes, essentially the NBA did not want another Kevin Durant to the Warriors situation. So now cap growth is going to be capped at 10% per year. So the cap is going to go up consistently. It's just not going to go up 30% in 1 year. We're never going to have another situation like the Warriors winning 73 games and suddenly having enough cap space to sign Kevin Durant. That ship has sailed.
And as you noted in your article on CBS, not only did all these free agents go for a crap ton more than what they were worth in 2016, a prime example being a Timofey Mozgov to the Lakers, but the 2018 free agents got squeezed as a result because everyone was, you know, hamstrung with those 2016 free agent deals on the books.
So, all the money got spent in one offseason, and then there was no money left over for anybody else. And it was funny because at the time, this was a really predictable outcome. And the NBA presented the players with a smoothing proposal. We don't know the specifics, but the players said, no, we want our guys to just get whatever they're going to get. My theory on this, and, you know, this is totally just speculation, is the people that really benefited from this were the agents, because there were probably a lot of agents in the summer of 2016 saying, I got Timofey Mozgov $64 million a year,
and you should sign with me. And by the time those guys signed in 2018 to come around, their rosters were already set. That's not reporting. That's just my speculation, but that would be my guess as to why we didn't get smoothing the first time. Now, both sides have learned they know better than to let that happen again. So what I would project when we have this 2025 new TV deal come in, you can just sort of pencil in a 10% cap bump every year after that. That would more or less be what I'd expect. So at least for the rest of the next CBA, after that, we'll, you know, reevaluate. But I would say we should expect 12, 13, $14 million raises in the cap every year.
Yeah, and they said they're going to progressively, like, if there's a huge TV deal and there would have been a huge cap spike had there not been cap smoothing, they said it over time it's going to, you know, end up evening itself out over the years.
Yeah, so, I think we don't know the exact plan for how that's going to work, but the way that the player salaries work is neither the players nor the owners can make more than 51% of total basketball related income. There's a band in there for a little bit of flexibility if, you know, revenues are higher than expected or salaries are higher than expected. But ultimately, the players are guaranteed that 49 to 51%. If it's not coming through the cap, it's coming in other ways. So the players are going to get their money regardless. We just don't know the structure of it yet.
The last thing I want to talk about is award winners and this new minimum of you need to play 65 games to basically be eligible for any NBA, All-NBA, MVP, defense player, all that. I believe it's going to apply to, you could correct me if I'm wrong, to all defense and all rookie, I would assume it would be as well if it's
for I believe NBA. So. I'm not as 100% sure on that.
But all from rookie a collective, would be tough.
Yeah.
Because so many guys, you know, it takes them until the All-Star break to really get going.
Well, a lot. I mean, there are rookies that play time in the G League and yeah, come back exactly. up. Like, that would be much harder. But from a CBA implication standpoint, the only one of the teams that matters is All-NBA because you can't earn Supermax eligibility with All-Defense or All-Rookie. So, I mean, the thing that I'm looking at here is if we have the 65-game minimum, well, how many of the best 15 players in the NBA right now played 65 games this year? Maybe half? Maybe less? Like, are we going to get ourselves in a situation where, I don't know, the 27th best player in the NBA makes an All-NBA team and is suddenly eligible for a Supermax contract? That opens up a lot of can of worms. Like, that makes things kind of complicated. So that's the thing that I'm kind of worried about, and I'm wondering if they built anything into the CBA to protect against that. Now, they are making all NBA positionless, which, number one, I just generally agree with in a basketball sense.
As do
and
I.
And number two, will probably curb some of the unworthy all NBA selections. So maybe that helps, but that's the red flag that I'm looking at here. Like, what happens when the wrong player becomes eligible for a Supermax and goes to his team and says, okay, I want Supermax. And they're like, no, we're not giving you a Supermax just because you stayed healthy. That's ridiculous.
Yeah, I mean, forgive me for whoever pointed this out. I'm blanking on who specifically. It might have been Kevin O'Connor and Chris Vernon on the mismatch, but I'm not positive. So I apologize for, you know, taking something and not appropriately citing it. But if you look at last year's All-NBA team and look at who played 65 games and who didn't, you have to go down the list so far that Desmond Bain, who got one or two votes for All-NBA last year, would have presumably made the team because enough guys didn't play 65 games. I mean, Desmond Bain's a hell of a player, don't get me wrong, but if
I don't think Memphis is giving him a Rose Rule max, I'll put it that way.
Yeah. And in your article, you discussed LeBron James. This is for this year. Guys like LeBron James, Kevin Durant, Kawhi, Steph, John Morant, Anthony Davis, Damian Lillard, Devin Booker, Paul George, all would not be able to play 65 games.
Well, Embiid now, too, I think, because he's going to probably sit out the last couple games.
Embiid,
right?
Embiid, I believe, is at
right on the borderline?
65 or 66. So okay, I think I looked at it this morning because I was curious. But Giannis
is not going to get to 65, right?
Let me look it up real quick.
Yeah.
I looked it up.
I'll make this basic point while you look it up. If you made three All-NBA teams of players above 65 games and three All-NBA teams of players below 65 games, I think the below 65 team would probably win. I think that team is probably a little bit better. We maybe have Embiid on the borderline. We maybe have Giannis on the borderline, so maybe that switches it. But you get the idea.
Yeah, so Embiid has played 66, so he would have been good. Giannis is at 63, so Giannis, I mean,
he's sitting tonight, I think, as of Friday.
Giannis probably would be sitting one of these next two, either tonight or Sunday, regardless. But now with this rule implemented, he would have to probably play if he wants All-NBA, which I'm sure he does. Of course he does.
Well,
he would
have
to play the last game of the year.
So we see this a lot on the last Sunday of the regular season. The guy who has a bonus at a certain number of games played, who will start that last game just to say he played in the game, commit an instant take foul, and just walk off the court. Jrue Holiday did this a few years ago. It's pretty common. I would like to do away with games played bonuses, make them minutes played bonuses for that reason. But that's something that we're probably going to see more of down the stretch.
Well,
and what I really wonder is, are we going to see guys who are legitimately injured do that for like four or five games at the end of the season?
Actually, now that you brought it up, Mike, the guy from The Athletic, Mike Vorkinov, he just posted a few hours ago, I actually saw it. This is his tweet. The new CBA will have a games played minimum for NBA postseason awards, 65 games with three exceptions, and at least 20 minutes in those games, but two games of 15 minutes are allowed. So, like,
okay. It's really 63 games then, essentially. Like, it was 63 plus you step on the court. Are you saying it's up
you
to
have
60?
To play at least 20 minutes in all 65 games, except two of them you could play 15 minutes. So, let's say somebody gets hurt in the first quarter of a game, and
that's not going to count. Yeah.
Yeah, that doesn't. So, if I sprain my ankle 10 minutes into a game and I'm out that game, but I'm back after that, or let's say I miss a few games and I'm back, I don't get credit for that game, even though it wouldn't be a Jrue Holiday or Draymond Green situation.
Okay, so while we're at it, then this is functionally, like, there are going to be guys that this is really a 66, 67, 68 minimum for.
Yes.
Because, like, there are a lot of guys, like, Giannis, I think, has had, like, three or four games this season where he's gotten hurt in the first half and left. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we'll
so
say
that's,
he's at 63
pretty punitive.
Now. Yeah. Yeah, he's at 63 now, so let's say he even gets to 65. It wouldn't have counted, probably, because he left multiple games pretty early on where he probably wouldn't have made. We wouldn't have played 15 minutes.
Yeah, Steven, well, that Giannis Antetokounmpo, he's not an All-NBA caliber guy. I don't know if it's
I
like
know.
He's not a real hooper.
I like the idea of it being positionless, especially as a Sixers fan. I'm a big, obviously, Joel Embiid advocate. I'm happy he's, you know, likely. It's still a good, tough MVP race that's going to happen, but the odds are in Las Vegas. I think he's minus 700 at this point.
He's going to win.
Yeah. But he's never made an All-NBA first team, which he's a top three player in the NBA in whatever order you want to put it, in my opinion. It's kind of ridiculous that he hasn't made an All-NBA team. And even last year, they made him and Jokic both both forward eligible on the ballot, but everyone wanted to be traditional. And then there's that whole Chris Middleton thing where he missed All-NBA and Ben Simmons made it because Middleton got more All-NBA points based off the votes than Simmons, but he got more votes at forward than he did guard. So Simmons made it as a guard. I mean, it was ridiculous.
Yeah,
notions.
It's a mess.
So I'm glad they're starting to resolve it, but we'll have to see. And of course, Jaren Jackson, who's the defensive player of the year favorite, him and Brook Lopez, one of the two will likely win it. He wouldn't be playing 65 games, which would have deemed him ineligible. And a lot of those games were early on in the year. So,
well, those games count as much as the late games. This is something that, like, I think if Jaren Jackson had gotten hurt in February and had missed the rest of the way, the odds would look a little bit different. My personal issue with Jaren Jackson is he doesn't play enough minutes.
Yeah.
He's going to end the season at, like, I don't know, between 16 and 1700 minutes. My personal rule that I might call this the Jaren Jackson rule. I want you to have played at least half of your team's minutes throughout the year.
Mm-hmm.
I don't care how that works as far as games played. You know, ultimately, I just want to, how can you be the defensive player of the year if your team played more than half of its defensive possessions without you? Like, that's just something that I can't understand.
No, that's definitely fair. But again, it's interesting to see because we're going to see how this 65-game rule affects different guys. As you just said, Giannis Antetokounmpo, not going to be an All-NBA guy. If
Bear won Defensive Player of the Year with 56 games a few years ago. Like, yeah. There are some real, you know, Embiid is the one that gets brought up here a lot because he almost won Rookie of the Year with 31 games. And by the way, I would have voted for Embiid at the time if I'd had a vote, and I don't now either. But it's a weird distinction, right? I mean, with MVP, we really tend to, like, comb through it, fine-tooth comb, whatever, like, look for every possible differentiation. Whereas for any of the year awards, we kind of just tend to look at it and go, like, who was the memorable one? And for the most part, I dislike that. But Embiid was so much better than everybody else when he was a rookie that I'm like, why do I have to pretend that Malcolm Brogdon had a better season than Joel Embiid? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, and in my opinion, if you don't want to give it to Embiid, I think Dario Saric should have got it that year. But that's a story for another day, Sam. So, okay. I think we covered just about all the main points of the CBAs, of the new CBA. Is there anything that you want to add? Or I think we did a pretty good job covering the basis of it.
Yeah, I think we covered most of the important points. But again, just the last thing I'll say is stuff is going to change. There's going to be more stuff that we get out of this. There are going to be more, you know, specific provisions related to each of these things. So I would just say more than anything, like, keep your eye on Twitter. Keep reading the stories as they come out. This thing is not over. It's going to get approved, and most of what's been reported is going to end up being correct. But there are going to be a lot more important details. So if you're an amateur capologist out there, just keep reading because there's going to be a lot more stuff. And, you know, I would say whenever Larry Kuhn's new FAQ comes out, that's, you know, book off a day and make sure you read it.
Larry Kuhn did post a podcast today on the Sports Business Classroom Pod with Dave DeFore about some of the provisions. So that's one I'm definitely going to have to listen to just to, you know, hear his
perspective.
Larry
is the cap father. Anybody here who's interested in the cap, like, go follow Larry, go read anything he writes, any podcast. Like, he is probably the best public capologist out there among all of us. So, I mean, like, just he is the, we all owe our amateur cap ambitions to Larry. So he's the GOAT.
Absolutely. That's a sentiment I'll 100,000% agree with. So you guys could follow me on Twitter at BirdRightsPod. You could follow Sam on Twitter at SamQuinnCBS. Rate and review the Bird Rights Pod, Apple Podcast, Spotify, while you're listening to this podcast. Sam, anything you want to plug?
Just read me at CBSSports.com. We're going to have a lot of good stuff as the play-in starts next week. Playoffs come. There's going to be a whole lot of fun stuff going on.
Okay. Then this concludes this episode of the Bird Rights Podcast. Sam, thank you so much for coming on. I am forever indebted to you between this and you helping me out with the mock trade deadline. You were awesome as the GM of the Lakers.
I think Rob actually did a better job than I did looking at it.
You know, I'm actually pretty happy with what Rob did. I know we just talked about how we're not Palenka guys, but I do think he set the Lakers up. And I know you posted a poll the other day of, would you rather have D'Angelo Russell, Malik Beasley, and Jared Vanderbilt as the two guys next to LeBron and AD? Or would you rather have KCP, Kuzma, and Caruso? And, you know, that's an interesting exercise. And the fact that I think it's even a question compared to the team that did find a way to win a championship, even though I know people can argue, it was in the bubble, blah, 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 it's a Mickey Mouse, whatever, I don't care. They won a championship. I think the fact that it's even comparable shows how good of a job Rob did do at the deadline, given how they were beforehand. So, for their sake, I hope they actually are in the play-in. If they get the 6 seed, I'm fine with it. I don't want them getting the 5, because I think them and Phoenix might be the two best teams in the West come playoff time next week.
So I'm happy that I think they're totally comfortable at number 7. I mean, yeah, I think they'd rather be 6. Everybody in the West wants to be 6. I think they would be comfortable at 7. I think the Lakers would go into a Grizzlies series and say, like, look, we're not the favorites. We don't have home court, but, like, you don't have Kevin Durant. You don't have Steph. Like, we're going to have the best guy in the series. We might have the two best guys in the series.
I agree with that. So
I think they would feel just fine. And I think the important thing for them was Phoenix is the one team that's going to give them the most trouble. Phoenix gave them so much trouble 2 years ago. I think they're totally comfortable playing against Denver. They've looked very good against Denver for years. You know, they beat Denver twice with Westbrook earlier in the season.
Mm-hmm.
Phoenix is the team they've got to hope gets knocked off by somebody else. So we'll see. And the Clippers too, but the Clippers, A, are not healthy, and B, don't have Paul George right now. We're headed for Clippers Suns in the first round. I think we both think the Suns are going to win that series comfortably. So I think, yeah, the Lakers right now are probably thinking, if Denver can take care of Phoenix for us in the second round and we're number seven, we've got a shot at this.
Yeah, I agree. I'm happy because I was saying, I don't want the Lakers getting five. I don't want a Suns-Lakers first round series. So I'm glad that, you know, the Clippers were able to win that game and, you know, have the Lakers avoid that. So, okay, it's playoff time. Time to talk playoffs. So that's going to be my next episode. You guys can be on the lookout for that. But until then, Sam and I will talk to you guys soon. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for having me.